You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Diane Wood Middlebrook, the author of the recent biography of Anne Sexton, published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm always saying Houghton. I wanted to welcome you here, and to begin by saying that today's show is only going to circuitously approach some of the controversy this book has generated. I'm more interested in the subject of writing and in the example that Anne Sexton set to other writers, and in the fact that this biographer, Diane Wood Middlebrook, is herself a poet. I wanted to begin by asking about, what would you call it, the legacy of madness. Denise Levertov famously, on the occasion of the death of Anne Sexton, talked about Sylvia Plath's death and the obligation that many young writers, particularly young women, felt to import a certain level of madness, mania in particular, and suicidal desperation into their lives in order to allow it to flood into the work. Could you speak a bit about that?
Yes, I think that Denise Levertov was speaking from a teacherly point of view about the dreadful spectacle of copycat suicides or students who were acting out madness as an exhibition of creativity. And Levertov knows as well as anybody that creativity and madness are allied in some ways, or sometimes the effect of breakdown is to liberate unconscious materials that are tremendously inspirational and fluent and exciting, but to talk about the health that lies in writing for writers and to encourage that perspective on it. So I think Levertov did enormous good by writing that obituary about Anne Sexton, saying that her legacy is the writing, but it's it may become an example to others to be suicidal. And so there was a disapproving air in the obituary.
There was a time in my life when I was so overwhelmed and overly sensitive to, I don't know, the darkness of the tones of both Plath and Sexton. Not, oddly enough, maybe time had removed it, Kit Smart. I can read the Jubilati Agno, particularly the cat section,
yes,
with enormous pleasure, but there were times when Sylvia Plath would literally make me frightened and anemic, and I took the books out of my house.
Yes.
Now, in the course of working on Anne Sexton, did you find yourself experiencing a kind of depression or...
Very much so. But it was in the area, in the period of research on the book, when I was finding out about particularly the last 2 years of her life, which are unbelievably sad. I had to dole out the material to myself. I could only work about an hour a day on anything that had to do with the years 1972-4, because she was so spectacularly and publicly deteriorated. She was drunk all the time. She was involved in a series of liaisons with men that were obviously very destructive. She was desperately lonely. All of the things that you hate to know about somebody, and they were the things that people remembered and often just needed to talk about with me. So I had to have the burden of their unloading it, basically. And I thought for a while during the months of the winter of 82, winter of 83, that I really couldn't. Maybe I shouldn't do this book because I felt so invaded by it myself and afraid. I think fright is the word, horror and concern and the ability, the contagiousness of depression, mm-hmm, which is real.
Well, there is an extravagant, you know, it's not as if, you know, for every Oedipus, someone said, there's a whole kingdom of cripples. And it's not as if any depressive has a poet bottled up waiting to be liberated. And it seems that Sexton in particular had an enormous gift for communicating the infectiousness of her vision.
I mean, agree with that. I think that's true. But I think she also was a person who showed the way that language, if you just let it pour out, that the jamming of images together often contained enormously powerful insights. And the excitement of words themselves as relief, as containing that energy in a way. I listened the other night to Salome Jens do a one-woman show made up of Anne Sexton's poetry, and indeed poetry that I don't like by Anne Sexton very much. Whenever I hear Salome perform these poems, however, their power comes back to me. They are very, very wild. They are late poems. I think they're unpruned. I think they're from Sexton's demonized alcoholic phase. I think that they're shapeless, and yet they have such compassion, such pathos, and such sometimes comic energy in them. They are quite overwhelming. And it's, that side of Sexton is the one I can't quite get into that band with her and feel still full of admiration for the artist. But I do know that it is the power of almost oracular tapping of an energy that other people recognize the feelings in, and that it's hers.
Poetry has a kind of history of going back and forth on the madness issue. To some extent, you know, the neoclassical poets are, in a way, answering the ravages of the Elizabethans. The Romantics become angry at the excessive logic of the neoclassicists, and they begin to worship unreason. Weirdly, a returner to the neoclassical state, Ezra Pound, ends up, nevertheless, put in an asylum, justly or unjustly, by the American government. And so, as Plato notices, there's a horrifying linkage, almost constant, between poetry and madness. Why do you suppose?
Well, let's call it poetry and possession. I think that was Plato's, would be an adequate conceptual translation. Possession by a voice that is not the reasoning voice, and yet... and this does seem to come through the poet from some other place. And that's, I think, the effect of that kind of voice. And we get in Shelley the "Be thou me, O wild west wind, thou breath of autumn's being." So that the poet is the temporary vehicle of some major force for which this poet's voice articulates the energy. And poetry seems to need that kind of refreshment from outside the narrow channels all the time. And I think your account of the tradition is a very nice one. That is, that there's a constant rebalancing, a movement one direction and another in poetry. When it gets excessively organized, then it needs to be disrupted again. It seems to me that when Anne Sexton began writing, what it needed to be disrupted by was a female voice speaking about confinement within not the conventions of art, but the conventions of femininity, and that Sexton's own transgressive voice was had great power because other people, men and women, recognized where it was coming from and what it had to say.
I'm talking to Diane Wood Middlebrook, the author of the recent biography of Anne Sexton. Now, in this particular regard, psychoanalysis provided a seedbed for her liberated poetry. And I began to wonder, you know, Harold Bloom refers to Freud as the maker of austere, harsh poetry. is psychoanalysis itself poetic? You had the opportunity, happy or not, to hear hundreds of unedited hours of a primary process, and I wondered, you have a sequence transcribed, which seems, you know, to me, you know, a kind of fascinating document. My interest in it is very lurid. There's a certain horror that I have really in its republication, but I did feel, you know, that it was like being able to see the notes for the poetic process itself, in whatever way that might be. Speak.
Yes, well, that's a good account. Well, Sexton herself learned a lot about writing. She changed her style because of listening to her own tapes, I think. Uh-huh. That listening, playing back the tapes herself, she could hear the way the process of association, the flow of association worked, And she said, and I wrote this up in the chapter called Poetry and the Unconscious, I think it's chapter 9, she said, the unconscious is always telling a story. And what you have to do is, after it's poured itself out, is go in with a little critic, which is the ego, and select the parts of it that make the story clearer. But mm-hmm. that she trusted that flow of association was itself expressive and narrative in character, so that listening to herself, she could hear the underlying narrative thread that was blossoming in the unconscious flow of things, and herself shape them as an artist herself. And I believe that that's probably what Bloom is referring to in Freud, the discovery that the unconscious, well, this is Lacan speaking now, is structured like a language, so that the what is not being said directly is being expressed indirectly through associations, the displacement and condensation factors of the verbal flow, and those are metaphoric in essence, so that there is a rationale to those metaphors, but it isn't the voice of reason, it's the voice of unconscious urge and association going on. So the process of listening to her own tapes, I believe, was inspirational to Sexton. It was also inspirational. To me, as I was able to hear her, though I concur that it's a vexed question whether anyone, including me, and I think I was terribly careful and, you know, full of integrity, et cetera, but still, should I have been a person permitted into that private space of Anne Sexton's language processing conducted in the presence of her doctor? I must say that it was a privilege so enormous that I will never forget it. And one of the things it brought me up against was the verbal artistry of Sexton just as a human being. That is, what came out of her lips and in the normal course of things was fabulous, kind of rich fluency in primary process. But it was produced with the kind of joy of being able to get it out. She very frequently would fall silent during these sessions, and those were the times when she was in great pain. But when she was moved or feeling things, her voice was full of, she could turn that into syllables.
I want to ask a final but difficult question. In thinking about fairy tales, I found myself at one point thinking of the breaking of thresholds. That in order for any story really to hold psychologically, certain barriers have to be destroyed. In the case of something that's not a fairy tale, but I guess a Markin, The Sandman by E.T.A. Hoffman, the child is told, for instance, that at night the Sandman comes and steals the eyes of children who are still awake. He plucks them from the child and puts them in his sack and takes them to the moon, where the moon owls gnaw on them.
I didn't know that story.
It's an amazing thing, and that's just the beginning of the story. Now, you know, horrible enough to imagine the taking of the eyes, and something that Freud and Lacan talk a good deal about. It's the basis of Freud's essay on the uncanny. But to take it in a sack, bring it to the moon, give it to owls who gnaw. This is a whole series of what I'm calling threshold or boundary violations. Now, in some way, incest is that kind of imaginative violation. It holds. You know, that there is a bursting there that sort of breaks the conventional expectation, whether in the Hoffman story it's the, you know, protection of the eye or the feeding of the human eye to animals. These are sort of what one might call incestuous moments or threshold-breaking moments in fiction. I wanted to ask at long length, I'm sorry, whether the incest is a necessary precursor to the intensity of transgressive and violating creativity that one finds in Sexton's work.
Your question is very rich, but as I was listening to it, I was thinking, isn't this a masculine sense that you're, I mean, violence, the snatching, the taking away. You know, the incest fantasy in Sexton is of reabsorption, of embrace, of the fluid boundary interpenetration, basically. That is, a return to a position where you don't know the difference between yourself and the other.
Mm-hmm.
And in her, it is not a violent experience. It is witnessed. When it is witnessed, however, it drives people mad. That is the fantasy in Sexton. And with either the male figure, the father figure in her fantasy, or the female figure in her fantasy, the desire to be embraced and absorbed, dissolved into this space of warmth and confusion, and erotic touching everywhere, perversity, that is what the drive is. And it seems to me that it generates in her a longing that can never be satisfied, and that is, in a sense, the key to it, that the desire for the crossing of the separated space is really the urge in her. So when it happens in the poetry, when it happens in the play, it is a yearning for God, in fact, or a yearning for the mother. When it happens in her life, in the memory of the her father's coming into her room and being drunk and sexually caressing her body, the one of the powerful things the play tells us about that is that the daughter yearns for this, and it's only when the great aunt interrupts it that it's exposed as filthy and disgusting, horrible and disgusting. So that there is a very complicated affect in that, in the play. In the memory of the fathers, in fact, there's an enormous yoking together of the daughter and the father toward the mother. Both of them desire her, but are only able to express their desire with each other. So Sexton really complicates the incest story very much and places it in the realm of female bonding and the peculiar way that the primary desire for in Sexton's imagination is for the mother, not for the father.
I've been speaking to Diane Wood Middlebrook. Thank you. Second guest today is Anne Lauterbach. She's the author of several books of poetry, most recent a book called Clamor, published by Viking. Now, I'm going to try and do something on the air today that I've never done before. This is a kind of poetry that's very exciting but new to me. And what I thought would be most interesting would be to have Anne Lauterbach read a poem and then, in a kind of what might amount to guessing game, my asking her questions about how it works, and let's see what happens. The poem that she's going to be reading is called Further Thematics. This is Anne Lauterbach, and she is reading from her book Clamor, published by Viking.
An ear's tall cavern, a mob climbing a twisted ladder with lunch pails, a bowl of fruit in an unseen field, boys and girls lingering at the rails, elders in another language guarding the entrance, telling soldiers lies, listening to the disordered music of the threshing floor. These might heal the intemperate largesse. These might enlarge the simple. The resilience began to hurt. Better to find names for the fallen, for the reluctant and aggrieved, missing from the precarious dissolves of the maid. Better to hunt in the marsh like a vagrant, call the dark-eyed boy beloved, his step quickening old words in the nick of time, his hand mated to her back as they uncoil the foreground, collapsing the known. Her flames lick at the parchment path, her eyes lift, a plea to watch as straw is flushed from the gutters, the sleeping beast toppled by wind, the hugely girthed moon tossed up over the horizon. Down by the river restaurant, the doctor is eating. He eats there often, watching the river snarl by the windows of the renovated factory. Wood panels, flags woven by the lame, pipes painted and digestive mantling the walls. The waiter is waxen with service. Trained as an acrobat, he speaks fluent French, is writing a book about angels. The salad bar attests to basic freedoms, a choice of dressings, olives, chickpeas, carrots. The doctor converses, listens to rumors, a new law passed, a girl tethered to a small town as to a door held open, just as she was about to speak wisely and kindly about the condition of women in her time. She had begun, "You must attend to the surface stroke or touch, not just to the image, those blooms reduced to postcards or the flatness of calendars." The doctor, losing interest, turns to watch the brown slur of water, its gullies, gaps, adhesions, cancellations. This is the firmament, however elusive. This is the naturalism of the obscure. Better to have names for the risen, call them word, visible, present.
That was Anne Lauterbach reading her poem Further Thematics from Clamor, recently published by Viking. Now, my first response is to some extent bafflement, followed by an enjoyment of the implicit humor. I find the sentence, "Down by the river restaurant, the doctor is eating," very funny. You know, I don't know why, but the flat fact of such an announcement in a poem that has so far been, well, you know, when I was listening, I thought of Keats and the Ode to Autumn in particular, the threshing floor,
right.
The bowl of fruit in an unseen field,
right.
A feeling of, in the Ode to Autumn, a lapsed goddess who had no temple. Then this doctor who seems to be full of taxonomies. You know, he's able to digest things. He needs to be served. He trains as an acrobat. He speaks Jewish French, and he even knows the language of the angels.
Well, no, it's the waiter who's trained as the acrobat.
Oh, yes, you're right. I'm sorry. Now, this is a New York detail.
Right. Now, actually, this oddly enough, this poem, there's a whole set of poems in this book that were written in Iowa City.
Uh-huh.
And there is a restaurant in Iowa City which has that's in an old factory by the river. And those images come from that place.
Well, this is where I get punished.
Oh, no, that's all right. There's always reality underneath the imagination, uh-huh. You know. It's very complicated how all these things. Anyway, you're right. The tone shift is deliberate to break down the high rhetoric that was building in the first part of the poem,
which I took to be natural and sort of romantic.
Right,
yes.
Right, and also this whole idea of finding names for the fallen, for the reluctant and aggrieved, missing from the precarious dissolves of the maid. You know, at the center of this poem is a desire to move away from the obvious narratives and descriptions of our world that the doctor would understand and know, towards something that is more mysterious and possibly more less easily accessible.
So
this is a poem sort of about that.
Is it as if his idea of freedoms are the choices at a salad bar, whereas the variety available to a poet and to the imagination are very much more wide than the salad bar world?
Well, I wouldn't want to be so
reductive.
Well, you're right. But I think that what for me, I would not say for a poet. I would say that language avails itself of this richness, and that it is the reductivity of the rational or the direct storytelling, I think we live in a culture in which we have reduced our freedoms to salad bars, and because of a failure of the imagination and our resistance to complication and indecision and ambivalence, all those great Keatsian things of negative capability, I suppose, is behind that. And this poem is really that opening. It's kind of like music. There's an opening thematic, which is a series of suggested images as possibilities of places to move into this more imagined and more complicated place. Now, the doctor is sort of tempted into this place. I mean, you can say more.
I'm playing. Here, just as she was about to speak wisely and kindly about the conditions of women in her time, she had begun, "You must attend to the surface, stroke or touch, not just to the image, These blooms reduced to postcards or the flatness of calendars.
So who do you think of there?
I thought of Ashbery.
Oh.
He has a poem in which a what is described as a trip across the Alps is then revealed to have been a ruler connecting two points on a postcard.
Right. Well, he does that so often because he's capable of shifting scales in this very particular way. I think of the instruction manual, for
mm-hmm.
example, where
mm-hmm.
you're suddenly in Guadalajara, you know.
And, yes,
and,
right.
But
who are you thinking of?
Well, this is actually, this is really about Georgia O'Keeffe.
Ah.
And it came out of, I used to be very active in the art world. And I had a conversation with somebody about Georgia O'Keeffe and how her work is so reduced to these rather corny and unpleasant, well, not unpleasant, but they're not very interesting as images because they're on calendars and on postcards. But if you actually look at an O'Keeffe painting, the surface touch is what makes it an extraordinary painting. It's the actual stroke of the brush on that. It's not the image. The image is really the least interesting part of a Georgia O'Keeffe painting.
Now we have around 3 minutes, which means that we enter a race in which the poet will, if she is kind, sort of, what would you say, overview the poem? Would you mind?
Overview the poem.
Give me a sense. I think we're getting a sense of, you know, two worlds, at least two, differently handled. Interpenetrability.
The possibility of these two worlds. I mean, the doctor, of course, represents the rational, right? And actually, my favorite part of this poem is this to watch the brown slur of water, its gullies, gaps, adhesions, cancellations. Of course, his life is full of adhesions and cancellations, and so is this water, and as well as gaps and gullies, and his preference for this churning water that he can put names to, he can put words to, and which he would call the naturalism of the obscure because he has some access to it.
Uh-huh.
And it's actually his voice that says, better to have names for the rhythm, call them word visible, present, whereas in the beginning it says, better to have names for the fallen, for the reluctant and aggrieved. And part of my project, to use rather a tedious word, is to try and find a way to start naming those things that are unnamed in our poetics as well as in the rest of our world. I mean, I live in New York City where the reluctant and aggrieved are indeed missing from the precarious dissolves of the maid. You know, they're expunged. And there's an enormous privilege involved in being a poet, but it doesn't mean that you have to write as if you were sitting in silk and looking at a still life. You know, because I ride the subways, and so not to be moralistic or righteous about it, but somehow to include that side of the world—not only the irrational, but the darkness in the culture—it seems at this point for me very important to be doing, and that's at the same time inviting the imagination to aid it, so that one doesn't simply become a social realist, because that's not interesting for me at all.
I want to thank you. It's not, I took a risk because, you know, to do this in public in front of readers who do not have a copy of the poem before them is a risk, but it was enjoyable and sprightly, and I thank you, Anne Lauterbach.
I thank you, Michael.
I'm talking, of course, to Anne Lauterbach, the author of Clamor, a book of poems recently published by Viking. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Coming up next on KCRW from the world of international business, Marketplace.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.